in a moment, Heather is going to give us our reading from chapter 1 of Proverbs. But I've just got a couple of notes about Proverbs while we start. I'm just going to mute that. There we are. So Proverbs is one of the wisdom books in the Old Testament, and the others are Job, Psalms, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. And there's a long history of wisdom, also known as Sophia, being a feminine or female aspect of God. And you'll note that Lady Wisdom is the protagonist in our reading from the start of the book of Proverbs. Our reading is from the Lively and Direct Message translation by Eugene Peterson. The wisdom books deal with human experience and what's involved in being human. The pithy Proverbs sharpen our observations and insights about what is going on all around us. And the wisdom writers keep us honest about and attentive to the entire range of human experience that God the Spirit uses to fashion a life of holy salvation in all of us. And Proverbs is framed as a book of advice to a young man at the start of his adult life. And one commentator says that the aim of the book of Proverbs is to subtract from the number of fools and to add to the number of the wise. Let's hear our reading.
This reading is from Proverbs chapter 1, verses 20 to 33. Lady Wisdom goes out into the street and shouts. At the town centre, she makes her speech. In the middle of the traffic, she takes her stand. At the busiest corner, she calls out, "Simpletons, how long will you wallow in ignorance? Cynics, how long will you feed your cynicism? Idiots, how long will you refuse to learn? About face, I can revise your life. Look, I'm ready to pour out my spirit on you. I'm ready to tell you all I know. As it is, I've called, but you've turned a deaf ear. I've reached out to you, but you've ignored me. Since you laugh at my counsel and make a joke of my advice, how can I take you seriously? I'll turn the tables and joke about your troubles. What if the roof falls in and your whole life goes to pieces? What if catastrophe strikes and there's nothing to show for your life but rubble and ashes? You'll need me then. You'll call for me, but don't expect an answer. No matter how hard you look, you won't find me. Because you hated knowledge and had nothing to do with the fear of God. Because you wouldn't take my advice and brushed aside all my offers to train you. Well, you've made your bed, now lie in it. You wanted your own way, now how do you like it? Don't you see what happens, you simpletons, you idiots? Carelessness kills. Complacency is murder. First, pay attention to me and then relax. Now you can take it easy. You're in good hands.
It's a powerful reading, and put in the translation of a message. It's very contemporary it quite thought-provoking. Because we came across that, we really, Philip and I, did think about that whole concept of wisdom. And one of the things I did under lockdown is I do look at more sort of emails and links and emails, and I get emails from Ngā Tonga Vision and Sound, which is the National Film Archives. And there was this amazing set of stories that are both in video and audio clips called Standing on Our Shoulders. And I've put the link in the order of service, and it's a whole selection of clips on women from Aotearoa who have really made a difference in their own ways. So we're going to look at three of those clips today. And I expect most of you will know at least two, if not three. Some of you may know none of these women. So excuse me, we will do a little bit of an introduction. Okay, so Suzanne Cowan is someone I know. She's a dancer, and she's the first, as it says here, the first person in the world to graduate with a PhD in dance while being a wheelchair user. She was disabled after a road accident while on her overseas experience. She gave up dance for 10 years, but returned to it seeing a performance by Touch Compass, a mixed ability dance company. Cowan joined Touch Compass and later Canduco, an international company. Returning to Aotearoa, Cowan was pursued an academic interest in the role of art as a vehicle for raising consciousness around disability and the way we view it. Her advice to anyone, especially anyone with a disability, is don't listen to other people's limitations. The possibilities are limitless. So there's a little video extract that we're going to watch of her.
Okay, now what I'm going to do is stop the share, get the video ready to go, then start it under the share. You'll notice, unfortunately, there's a little bit of a lag between the sound and the video action. So it just doesn't quite sync up right when you're viewing it at your end. But here we go. It won't be a moment.
One of the things, really valuable things I've learned about working in with Canduco is working as part of a team, and that's what I really enjoy about being in the company. Basically, you learn to look out for other people, and you learn that it's not just about you. You're one of seven dancers, and you know what everyone else is doing is just as important, and that you all have to work together to achieve whatever it is. A lot of the work we do involves weight sharing with other dancers, weight sharing with each other, and it works particularly well, I think, with people with different kinds of physicalities. So it does involve a lot of trust, really trusting each other that somebody's going to catch you, someone's going to support you, and it's also knowing how much weight you can give at a particular time and how much weight that particular person can take and where you can give it, where you can take it. And all that sort of information is something that you just build up working with somebody over a long period of time.
Make dance accessible to anybody who's interested, who wants to do it. Not saying that everyone will become a professional dancer, but at least dance is so fundamental in life, and so that's, I suppose, what I mean. It's inclusive.
I think there's a lot of opportunity for sort of personal growth, I suppose, as well as professional growth in that sort of environment. And I think one of the things I really enjoy the most about being in the company is travelling internationally and touring. And that's really good fun. I mean, sometimes we don't stay in these places a long time, particularly in Europe, because it's not far to get there and it's not far to get back, and sometimes we'll just go for one show. But the further afield we go, the longer we stay. And like earlier this year, we went to Sri Lanka and we spent a week there. And I mean, that was just amazing. And, a completely different culture and fantastic audiences. We always get fantastic audiences abroad.
Thanks, Philip. So just a reflection question. for a person like Suzanne, how do you see her wisdom? What is the wisdom that she's brought to us, has offered? And what difference her work and her mission has been? So if you want to reflect, put your hand up, and then we'll just do a few people because we've got three video clips. So what made an impression for you?
If you want to talk, just press the space bar on your PC. You might have to click on and off the volume if you're using something else, but space bar and then talk will work.
I guess it was interesting. She was talking about how different people can support, are able to support different weights, and how, I guess, when you're in that situation, you're trusting people and such, and you have to think about sort of how much weight you can put on other people, and in that sense, it's everyone's different, and the line between disabled and non-disabled, really, it's just an arbitrary line in a way, because everyone's different.
Yeah, I found that it's very inspiring that, I mean, if you think about somebody like her, who has this, she has different abilities, for want of a better term, instead of saying a disability, but this is not a showstopper. I reckon most people, they would think that's unreachable, that's can't do it, how am I supposed to do this, given I can't move in the same way people who usually do these sort of courses and PhDs can. But yeah, so that is pretty inspiring. Yeah.
I noted when I was reading about this just last night that she has a PhD in dance, and we sort of assume that anything like this requires excellence in performance. That's to say a certain body type, say, or, you know, the best performance. So I'm thinking as an equivalent to when Christopher did performance degree in saxophone, he had to do a really high quality, best kind of performance. But there's also the kind of degrees where you learn about things, and it's not about being just the typical musician. It's about, you know, so I mean, I thought it was really inspiring that she could have a PhD in dance, and it's very all opportunities in that regard, quite a lot like Drama Christie, you know, that we can take all kinds of people and produce a group effort, and it doesn't have to be necessarily the best in the world, but everyone can participate. That's sort of key thing, seemed important to me.
And more.
I just thought that having her limitations and the sort of movement that she could achieve made her have to be more creative. And I was really impressed with the sort of types of movements she could sort of put into the dance. Really the amazing range and type of movement, you know, including kind of lifting herself slightly in her chair. And I think it seemed like it made her have to think in a whole different way about movement and how to incorporate, you know, different sorts of it into the dance. So that was interesting.
Thanks. For me, a really important part that she spoke to about normalising dance for everyone. So that whole sense of everybody is able-bodied. And also from a public perspective, she's doing a lot to actually get over the barriers that people have about what's possible and what's not possible and who is able and who is not able. So to me, she's making a big difference. And it's a world I really am invested in. So I'm very grateful for that. Okay, well, the next...
I think, Jeffert, you've got something you want to say.
Yeah. For me, as I observe on the on the performance. It's like this different, you know, like capacity of people, different, you know, level of, like, you know, ableness, we call it. What I say is that if we like reflect on it, for me, it's like the more that we are able, the more that we have like more opportunity to, you know, to support others. Just like in the dance, those the other that are, you know, they're complete. The more that we have like a very good opportunity to help others who have like, you know, all those are like limited when it comes to their capacity to perform in life, or yeah, that's the thing. So even yeah, it doesn't matter if you are like disabled, because like Dr. Cowan, even though he's disabled, but he's still able, because there are things also you can equip, we can equip ourselves to be like even we're not very physically complete, but we can equip with some, you know, knowledge that we can also support others, even because it doesn't mean that you are disabled, but in other ways we can equip ourselves, you know, to help others. It's more on my reflection on that is like, yeah, more on support system. With as a Christian community, we have different, like, we have different capabilities, we have different incapabilities also. So the more that we are equipped, the more that we have opportunity to support others.
Awesome. Thank you.
If I could just say one thing, going back to the PhD that Suzanne has got, to get a PhD, you need to be, first of all, a graduate at a lower level, so have a bachelor degree. But then you do a lot of research, and a PhD where you write your thesis, what it's doing is bringing new knowledge about that topic into the world. So that's what your PhD is judged on. How well you support that argument, how well you've done your research and brought it together. So there's new knowledge and therefore new wisdom, which is available to other academics and mm-hmm. other dance professionals. So it's a very strong and capable and inspiring thing that she's done to be able to get to study to that level.
Correct. Yeah.
Our second person, sorry, I'm bumping us along, because actually we could spend a long time on this and I want us to keep to our time. Our second person we're looking at is Dame Professor Marilyn Waring. Just at the age of 23, when she was elected in 1975 to Parliament, Marilyn Waring was one of only four women MPs, and she was half the average age of all MPs. As a young feminist, Waring was a threat to her male colleagues. She was considered revolutionary when in 1984, after being blocked from speaking in the House on the nuclear issue, she advised the National Party leadership that she would cross the floor on the issue. Prime Minister Muldoon responded by calling a snap election, which Labour won by a landslide. And then she retired from politics 1984, but has never stopped advocating for women. So we've got a snap of her from, I think, in Parliament.
I think the Muldoon years, when Marilyn Waring was, for most of that period, the only woman in the National Caucus, must have been an absolutely devastating period for her. And as she began to develop her own ideas and perspectives more, she became increasingly unacceptable to male colleagues. And in the end, I think, probably did walk into a wall of hatred.
For those who had not known an activist woman as a parliamentary colleague, and as men came into the House in 78 and 81, they found it a definite threat. These were the men of the generation, of course, who'd grown up with women who read the feminine mystique, who read the female eunuch, who just weren't taking none of that shit no more.
She leaves the impression that she is at war with the ordinary housewife and all the men in the world.
But the Prime Minister cannot make government policy of his own volition.
You're opposed to Mr. Kidd's bill.
What's it's preposterous. Absolutely preposterous. They love having women in Parliament, but they want women they can control. Women in a man-made model. And you don't fit the model. So you're a problem.
There's a woman who walked a very hard journey. So, let's think about the wisdom that she brought and the difference she made.
She was really punished for what she did and punished and blamed for her perspectives and made a scapegoat, I think. I think that's quite clear that she was blamed for that snap election.
That part of it's interesting, the politics, because the particular issue wasn't a confidence issue, so it wasn't something that the government was going to have to resign if they lost that particular vote. But Prime Minister Muldoon clearly had enough of wearing and used that as an excuse. John Kirk, who was the son of Labour, Norman Kirk, he crossed the floor. He was prepared to support the National Party at the time. And after the 1981 election, the National Party had quite a slim majority in power. So the whole political situation was really interesting.
I think her courage back there just really comes out strong. Being, you know, going against the grain, and I mean, it challenges us in these days to do the same, because you take you take courage and you make big steps for the future, I guess, and that was quite inspiring to see her courage come through.
I was just thinking, she's 23 and the only woman in Parliament representing 50% of the population, for better or worse, you know. That's quite daunting, being that young and being assured of yourself but being shouted at by older men who are your father's age. I can feel that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too to think of the time back then. I've been watching the Panthers TV series of Sarah, and that gives you a really interesting view into what the 70s was like in New Zealand, and you know, that was the environment she was working in. It's a completely different political environment from today.
Not entirely. I noticed that some of the things referred to in there are still happening, that people are being barred from speaking.
And in New Zealand, of course, that nuclear-free movement, she made a huge difference to get that rolling, and that by 1985, I think it was, we had declared ourselves as nuclear-free. Now, that was huge at the time. It's something we don't think about anymore, but at the time, it was a worldwide impact that New Zealand declared itself nuclear-free. And what a difference that has had consequences around the world. So her story sits in my gut, it always does. So, and she made me think of Jesus' path, who was also prepared to put up with such abuse and opposition to stick to what he believed in and the message he had. So very strong parallel to me in the wisdom that she brought forward.
Wendy, did you want to say something? Press and hold your space bar.
One more time.
Sorry, press and hold it down.
Oh, yeah. It's just always reminds me of the passage in the verse in Wisdom that speaks to me is that wisdom is found in the marketplace. And to me, that's just another example of it. I love the wisdom passages. I think they're really important that that's where wisdom is found. And certainly that's what I take of that. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we'll move on to our third section. And this amazing woman, Dame Fina Cooper. Dame Fina Cooper was a charismatic leader whose cry, "Not one more acre of Māori land," inspired the 1975 hikoi from Te Hapua in the far north to Parliament in Wellington. Aged 80 at the time, Fina Cooper is perhaps best known for the Land March and the new era of protest and reform it ushered in. It was not, however, her only achievement. Among others, she was the foundation president of the Māori Women's Welfare League. When she stepped down in 1957, the conference bestowed the title to Te Whaia o Te Motu as the public face of the league. She had become one of the best known Māori women in the country. Let's watch the video.
This land is ours.
In March of 1975, Fina formed Te Matakite, a land rights organisation which united a wide variety of people angry over the continued loss of Māori land. At a meeting at Mangere Marae, Fina challenged them to come up with a plan of action. Vivian Hutchison, a young journalist then, new members.
It was quite a large meeting on the Marae itself, and I remember tremendous frustration with the issues being placed on the Marae. She asked people to come up and place their take or their issues on the Marae. There was the Raglan land case, there was the Ngāti Wai land case, there was the Bastion Point land case, and a whole continuing stream of different issues facing the people at that time. And there was a whole series of just quite frustrating events of how they just weren't getting anywhere with the whole issue.
Town and country planning, public works, ahatu ngama moture.
Fina added to that sense of frustration by listing the various acts of Parliament which had taken land out of Māori control, but offered no solution about how to get it back. Then over lunch, Vivian had a conversation with Joseph, Fina's eldest son.
I suggested to him that the idea of a land march should take place where people go from the top of the country down to the bottom. It would take about a month. And I said to him, by the time you get down there, all eyes will be on this issue. Well, Joe took this idea to his mother, who really didn't make much of it at the time. But later on the Marae itself, Graham Latimer was there, who was the president of the New Zealand Māori Council. And he had heard all these take or issues before. He stood up and said to Fina, "What's going to be different about this Matakere thing? We've heard the stories, we've heard the frustration, why have you got us here?" And much to our surprise, Fina just got up there and then and said, "Well, I'm going to march."
"We are marching to Parliament. And no more land to be sold."
Fina convinced Māoridom to support the land march by personally visiting every marae, just as she had done in the days of the Māori Women's Welfare League, explaining, cajoling, humouring.
"But of course when I'm gone, I hope that I look down and still pray for them. If I get up there, I'll never let one pake come up there anyhow."
The march began on September the 14th from Te Hapua, on the top of the North Road. It was more than coincidence that this was also the home of the then Minister of Māori Affairs.
"Wellington, here we go.
From day one, the sight of an 80-year-old Maori woman walking on Parliament with her 3-year-old granddaughter had New Zealanders spellbound. Maori land rights were suddenly big news, and Fina soon found herself interviewed by reporters with very English accents.
Aren't they satisfied?
Doesn't the land of any country belong to all the people of that country and not to any special groups?
Because we own New Zealand. Good gracious me.
Sorry, I still get tears when I watch that. Such a powerful image. So just skip me, but please give your reflections.
Wow. This is a reflection of what happened to us. This woman reminds me of one of our great women who actually did almost the same thing, but this was like in the 1800s. She says, my bones would not sleep until the land goes back to the people. Wow, it's so powerful. Women like this, they need to be remembered. Her name was Ambuya Nehanda, and she's one of the legends of Zimbabwe. In every ceremony that we do, we actually think about her. My heart is actually beating 1,000 kilometers an hour. I can't believe it. I've never watched this. It's just reflected so much on me. We need people like that in the world. We do need people like that in the world. Thank you.
Her energy certainly comes across, doesn't it? 80 years of age, it's absolutely amazing to be able to get up and speak with such passion. I think that she was certainly a woman and a figurehead for the Land March and for that time.
I remember Tim Priestley, despite her name, this is a lady who was at Drama Christie and Wesley for years, who also led by example, including getting onto the runway in Wellington to stop, I think it was the 1981 South African rugby team landing. So the numbers of people went onto the airport runway and got arrested, and she was 80-something at the time, I believe, as well, also leading by example with things she believed in. So she's someone who's part of us as well, remembering Tim Priestley.
Like you, Daphne, I find that last image of Fina walking with her grandchild or Mokopuna very powerful. And it's one of the iconic images in New Zealand.
And when we ask what difference did she make, she was before the time of the Treaty of Waitangi, the Waitangi Tribunal. But I'm sure that she started the ball rolling. And to think that, yes, there has been change for Māori, there has been land returned, there has been some justice done, not full, but justice has been done and hopefully will still be done. So again, the strength of a woman and the guts she had to just not do nothing, to do something. And again, that example of to act on the wisdom and the sense of justice and need for justice was huge. So again, I feel very humbled to see that and know of her. Anything else?
I remember of her back in the Philippines also. I remember over, you know, during the regime of Ferdinand Marcos back in the Philippines. I think he's the very famous president in the Philippines. And he's very famous also in the world, Ferdinand Marcos. But he was a very authoritative kind of person, because he reigned like 20 years, in which he twisted the law. The law that he can that allows him to run the Philippines for 20 years. But it was a woman. It was a woman in the presence of Cory Aquino who revolt to him and brings the people, the Filipinos, to take him down from monopolizing the Philippines. So that woman, I reminded of her from our late President Cory Aquino. She's just a simple housewife from a senator, but you know, it doesn't matter if you're a woman, but if you have like something, God vested you a power, a kind of leadership that leads the people or leads to a changes, for a change, even how powerful you are being facing of that kind that you want to change. And if you have that kind of powerful leadership, you can convey people, and it is the people that always also, you know, even how powerful, how corrupt kind of, you know, you're facing like a situation it is, you can achieve it. So she reminds me of our late president Cory Aquino, and lots of powerful revolution back in the Philippines in the year 1986. I was still a kid at that time. Thank you.
Thank you.